Okay, the first question this evening. Adya Ajahn Brahm, some scholars. Well, that's a bad start for the question. Through means of language, say the Parinibbana Sutra or some parts of it are added on at a later stage. Is that true? Which part? If so, roughly how much later? Could it be at the second council? As for the Abhidharma, did that come about at or after the third council? If the Abhidharma text is not spoken by the Buddha, whose words were they and how accurate are they? Please clarify. Great question. It's the Parinibbana Sutra was obviously after the time of the Buddha because it recalls the Buddha dying. So it must have been after the time of the Buddha because the Buddha couldn't talk about when he died. So it's after the time of the Buddha. And added on at the later stage, it seems to be that it was something which did develop, but many parts of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta are in other parts of the Pali Canon as well. It seems they've collected some of these parts and put them all together. And it does seem to be original, authentic, if nothing else, because of the contents of it. For a good example is of this, they have the seven reasons why the Sangha, or actually any community, will always prosper. And one of those is you always meet together regularly, in harmony. You discuss things in harmony, and you leave together in harmony. He was actually just saying that if you're any community, you have to meet together and discuss things, but not with a spirit of ill will, or trying to do one better than the other person. But actually harmony was the most important thing, and to meet regularly. So, you know, as monks we try and meet regularly, at least once every fortnight. And this hall here will be used in December for what we call the Western Abbots meeting, where we have all these monks from all over the world coming here just to meet together and just discuss, you know, what's happening in Buddhism and our tradition in different parts of the world. And that's in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, but it's also in the Anguttara Nikaya as well. We have such sayings in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is, how do you know what is Buddhism or not? And they say, even if it's a very senior and very highly attained monk, just because he says it, you shouldn't just think that that is the teachings of the Buddha. But you should compare it with the Vinaya and the Sutta. And if you find that it compares with the Vinaya and the Sutta, you say, Venerable Sir, well said. And there is actually something which we call it the great standards for how we use a criteria to decide what was spoken by the Buddha and what wasn't spoken by the Buddha. And already you see the Vinaya, this very old list of rules, but it's not just a list of rules. In the Vinaya you have such things like the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, the first sermon, because the Vinaya also includes the early life of the Buddha. And has a lot of other really fascinating, very interesting Dhamma teachings in the Vinaya. And also the suttas. And we all know what the suttas are. Notice it doesn't say compare it with the Abhidhamma. It's one reason already why the Abhidhamma is certainly much later after the time of the Buddha. And there's many other beautiful sayings in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, such as the monk, well, he's not a monk, he was a wanderer, Subhadda. He tried to see the Buddha just when the Buddha was about to die. Ananda said, look, don't bother, the Buddha's very sick and very weak. And the Buddha overheard it. Let him come, Ananda. And this wanderer, he asked this amazing question, and the Buddha gave this brilliant answer. He says, in other traditions, can people become enlightened? It's a great tradition, great question, isn't it? In other traditions, can people become enlightened? And the answer of the Buddha was, in any place you find people practicing the Eightfold Path, there you will find supreme winners, once returners, non-returners, and fully enlightened beings. It doesn't matter what you call the tradition. What really matters is what you're practicing. It doesn't matter whether you call it Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, MTV, Christianity, Islam, or whatever you call it. It's what you're doing. So if you're a hard-nosed Theravada, and you're not practicing the Eightfold Path, you won't get any stages of enlightenment. And the Eightfold Path, the Buddha is making this point here, it's what you do, and the Eightfold Path is the way to become enlightened. So if you're only practicing the Sevenfold Path, no enlightenment. You all know what I mean by that. the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, consistently, is jhana, 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 jhana. That's Sama Samadhi, the eighth factor. But don't just believe me, even though I'm a senior, well-respected monk. Compare what I've just said with the suttas and the Vinaya. As I mentioned earlier, that's the great standards. And you compare it, you'll see that every time you mention Sama Samadhi, it's always jhanas. So if you're practicing the sevenfold path, even though you may, in other words, no jhana at all, so-called pure vipassana, you won't find people being enlightened. Because it's not practicing the sevenfold path. It's not practicing the Eightfold Path, it's only practicing the Sevenfold Path. And that is the teachings of the Buddha. Don't just believe what I say, compare it. You have also this other great sort of teaching, when at the time when the Buddha was about to pass away, all these people were worshipping the Buddha, bringing all these, they used to bring these scents, like incense, flowers. They didn't used to get into candles in those days, but you know, incense and flowers. So the Buddha told Ananda, he said, you don't worship a Buddha by offering incense and flowers. He said, you worship a Buddha by practicing his teaching, following his advice. That's how you worship a Buddha. It's a great little teaching. Because sometimes, you know, in many temples, we go and do pujas, worship. And we supply all these flowers, all these candles, all these other stuff, and get these big ceremonies, and people go back, and the first thing they do when they get home, actually apparently before they get home, they go into the car park, open the boot of the car and have a swig of whiskey. Just after this has happened in the Buddhist Society of Victoria in Melbourne, people told me. They go to the big Waisak ceremonies, they keep the five precepts, some of them keep the eight precepts, and as soon as the ceremony is over, they can't even wait to go home, open the boot of their car, and get the whiskey out and have something to drink. Now, that's not worshipping the Buddha at all. That's actually, you know, almost in Australia, putting one finger in the face of the Buddha. That's really disrespect. So, the way you worship a Buddha is not with these ceremonies. Ceremonies are okay, but you don't worship a Buddha with flowers, candles, incense, and this other stuff. You worship it with your practice, what you do. And that's the same that, you know, if you think you're a disciple of mine, you don't worship me or, you know, pay gratitude to whatever I've done by offering me things. You don't worship a monk by offering an ang pao. An ang pao is these little red packets which they offer to monks in Singapore, Malaysia and other places. You worship a monk by practicing the teachings of the Buddha. And that's true, I feel like that. The best gift you can ever give to me is come up and say, oh, I've got jhanas, oh, I'm enlightened. And that's the best gift. Your practice is a gift. And that's what the Buddha said in Mahaparinibbana says. It's brilliant stuff. So whether it was added to or not, I can't see that's added. That's got the smell of the Buddha. That's got the taste of the Dhamma. So all of that is pretty accurate. So there are maybe little bits and pieces may have been added, but I think they're authentic teachings from what happened at that time. Mahaparinibbana Sutta. But as for the Abhidhamma already mentioned, it's clearly not the teachings of the Buddha. Evidence, already mentioned, it's not mentioned in the suttas. Then the powerful evidence is if you look in the Vinaya Pitaka, which is where you got the account of the first council. After the Parinibbana of the Buddha had passed away. Usually what happens when the great teacher passes away, there can very easily be splits. You know, and you know, this person said, oh, the Buddha taught this. No, he didn't say this, he taught something else. It's very easy to have arguments when the authority has passed away. So one of the senior monks, Mahakasapa, saw that possibility and arranged a convocation, like a conference of all the senior monks, 500 of them, to come together so they could actually get all the teachings together to collect them and approve them. When you got like the 500 superstars, you know, the big great arahats of that time, all agreeing, then no one else would be able to argue with it. So they rehearsed. They recited all of the Dhamma and also the rules of Vinaya, both monks and nuns, for posterity. And it's recorded, and it's not just the Theravada tradition, All the other versions of the of this second first council all say the same. First of all, Upali recited the Vinaya. Upali was the Vinaya expert. And then Ananda recited the Pancha Nikaya, the five Nikayas. They don't say what those five Nikayas are, but everybody knows that those are the Digha Nikaya, what we call the long sayings, the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings, the Anguttara Nikaya. It's actually usually say Sanyutta Nikaya first, which is, what do they call the Sanyutta Nikaya? Connected discourses, yes, good enough. Anguttara Nikaya, the numericals are 1, 2, 3s. And the last is the Kudaka Nikaya, which has such things as the Dhammapada and the Sutta Nipata and the Udana. And those are the five Nikayas. We know what those five Nikayas are. And conspicuous by its absence, the Abhidhamma is not mentioned at all. So it's very clear that it wasn't recited at the first council. It wasn't the word of the Buddha. And the other pieces of evidence, as Buddhism sort of spread throughout the different places in the world, as it spread, sometimes we had a common core. Even now we have a common core of Vinaya and suttas. Our rules of discipline, whether you're a Mahayana monk, a Tibetan monk, or a Theravada monk, our rules are basically exactly the same. Some people don't keep those rules, but the rules are basically the same. Usually the Tibetans follow the Dhammagupta Vinaya. If you look at it, it still has the same rules of not accepting money, having these robes of rags. It's exactly the same rules, but even the Dalai Lama, he wants the Tibetan tradition to keep those rules of Vinaya again. And if they do, Tibetan monks, Mahayana monks, Theravada monks, we'd be indistinguishable. Because our Vinaya is so close together, and our suttas, in the Mahayana, they're called the Agamas. And monks like Ajahn Sujato and Analia, they've been actually comparing the Chinese Agamas with the Pali Nikayas, or Pali suttas, and they're so close together. And you're getting a huge amount of correlation. The suttas and the Vinaya are common to all traditions. But Abhidhamma, totally different. And it looks to be that the Abhidhamma was actually what split the sects, you know, from the different early sects of Buddhism. All on Abhidhamma. They've got totally different Abhidhammas. And that is a very good sign. The Abhidhamma was added afterwards. And because it was added afterwards, it didn't have the authority of being the word of the Buddha. You added your one, you added your one, someone else added the other one, and they were all arguing. Abhidhamma is totally different. Then also, as I mentioned, the linguistic analysis, where you can compare Chaucer to Charles Dickens to Harry Potter, very different language. And you can actually know how words change. If you look at Charles Dickens, you might say that Mr. Pickwick was a very gay fellow. Now that didn't mean he was homosexual, he was just happy, happy-go-lucky. And of course the word gay these days has a totally different meaning. Words do change as the years go by. And you can actually understand by the way the words are used in context, what they mean, you can actually date those texts. And the scholars have done that to the Abhidhamma. If you really want to get the book which actually tells you about this, it's Indian Buddhism by Professor A.K. Warder. And the Indian Buddhism by A.K. Warder, he's not a Buddhist. Even though he was knew a huge amount about Buddhism, he was living in Toronto. I was visiting Toronto a year ago, and I thought of actually going to sort of go and see him just to pay my respects, because he's a great scholar. He's very, very sick, and people tell me in Toronto, the other Buddhists, they know him very well, and he's very old now, and he's not a Buddhist because he doesn't believe in reincarnation. So he's not a Buddhist, but he was a scholar who wanted to find out what the Buddha taught. He was a scholar at Cambridge. That's why he's okay. And because he was a scholar, he was like a referee. He just wanted to find out what did the Buddha actually teach and what was added on afterwards. And there you can see all these amazing, powerful arguments about, mostly about the use of language and how you could date the Abhidharma to a couple of centuries after the time of the Buddha, which is where it started from. And another piece of evidence which I like to quote is the Gulisana Sutta, which is in the Majjhima Nikaya. Because there, Gulisana Sutta is about the Buddha admonishing the forest monks. That's us guys, the monks who live in the forest. And one of the things he said, you forest monks, you should know more than the village monks about Abhivinaya and Abhidharma. Not just Abhidharma, but Abhivinaya as well. And that's one of the only places, I think it's the only place in the whole suttas where they mention the word Abhidharma. And it's something which the forest monks should know more about than anybody else. And Abhivinaya they should know more about. So what Abhivinaya? That must mean the restraint. Not just the rules of conduct, but just the further restraint which you know, you're supposed to have as a forest monk, someone who lives even more simply than the rules permit. That's the deeper. Abhi means like the deeper restraint. And the Abhidharma. Now the forest monks don't get into reading books. That's the city monks. So if these forest monks knew more about Abhidharma, what the Abhidharma meant originally was the deeper explanations of Dhamma, Jhanas, the sort of stuff I've been teaching here, which is in the suttas but further than the suttas. That's what the Abhidharma means. And that's why that a monk like Ajahn Mahabua, whenever he mentioned the Abhidharma, he'd beat his chest. I won't do this because I'm getting old these days. He'd pump his chest really hard. I've done it a few times and bruised myself just trying to imitate him. He'd thump his chest and go, this is the Abhidharma in here. It's not in a book. And that was the original Abhidharma. So that's actually what it really meant. And what we have now is stuff which is not the word of the Buddha. It makes things far too complicated. You don't have to study it to become enlightened. Keep to the suttas. They're the sort of the heart of the teachings. And the Buddha was a great teacher. When he taught, everybody could understand it. And you look in that time of the Buddha, prostitutes would become enlightened. Hunchbacks, beggars would become enlightened. And these weren't people who had university degrees. Buddhism is not just for doctors. It's just for ordinary bricklayers, ordinary street sweepers, as well as other people. So it had to be something really simple but profound. If you look at the Abhidharma, oh, it just, you know, makes your head spin. So, not necessary. I don't mind saying that. People can argue with me, but the evidence is so strong. Anyone want to mention anything about that? Sorry? Abhi means like deeper or further. Bit of extra. Okay, next question. Teflon mind to refer to Anallyo. May Ajahn indulge us on this practice on its deep level. Alaya, this word, it's a Pali Sanskrit word. You all know this because you know it from such things as Hima Alaya. Hima means snow. Remember the Himalaya? That's actually the proper pronunciation, not Himalaya, Himalaya mountains. It's the abode of snow, where snow sticks. There's another state in India called Megha Alaya. It's Megha means clouds. It's the abode where the clouds always stick. They don't have many sunny days up there, apparently. It's very cloudy. So Alaya means the place where things stick. So Analaya means no sticking. Now what sticks to you? You can understand that your past sticks to you. What happened to you? Who hurt you? Your ex-wife, your ex-husband, or what someone said to you today? Or what happened to you today, the journey you just had last year, and you want it back again? It's sticking to you. Let it go, for goodness sake. Your reputation and status, that's just all the past. Let it go. Have a mind to it. Nothing sticks at all. Literally in one ear and out the other. So you just are empty, peaceful, free. So whatever comes, you have a terrible meditation. It's gone already. Don't let it stick. Have the most brilliant meditation you've ever had. Don't let it stick. Have nothing stick. We're not meditating to gain things, to amass things. When I was young, I never made it to the Boy Scouts. I was in the Boy Scout Cubs. We get all these badges. You'd make a cup of tea, and you'll get a badge for being able to make a cup of tea. You'd be able to light a fire, and you get a badge for lighting fire. All these badges. And that's also what people do in meditation. They want a jhana badge. Wouldn't it be wonderful if at the end of this retreat I could give out badges? Yeah, you've got a nimitta, and you get a nimitta badge, this brilliant bright light badge, which is fluorescent in the dark. You've got a jhana badge. You've got a sotapanna badge. Now you can see what happens. That's wanting attainment. And that's actually nothing to do with the path. So we're not doing anything to stick anything on us, like badges. Please let go of everything. Otherwise it becomes like the spiritual materialism. After the retreat, you talk to each other. How did you get? What did you do? He said, I got nothing. Nothing! Oh, I got these great nimittas. And the next one said, great nimittas, that's nothing. I did that the first day. I got the jhanas. Jhanas? Oh, that's nothing. I got stream winning. Stream winning, that's nothing. I was flying through the air in the evening. I got fucking... Now this is just this one-upmanship, which is nothing to do with Buddhism. It's what we call spiritual materialism. And because of that, the Teflon minds, we don't hold that at all. Imagine if all your attainments you completely let go of because they don't stick to you. Where's your ego gone? Completely vanished. Because your ego is built up of all of your attainments. In the world, in life, and all of your guilt is built up of all of your failures. Imagine that nothing sticks to you. You've got no guilt, no pride, no ego. Totally free. Isn't that a wonderful state? So nothing sticks at all. Completely let it go as soon as it happens. That's a letting go of the past. Which means that you are free. Let's see, a place where nothing sticks. A mind which as soon as something lands on it, it flies off again straight away. So you accumulate nothing. And the other simile, which I gave many years ago, is my mother's old mantelpiece. A mantelpiece in an English house is a shelf over the fire. And on that shelf, you usually put mementos of journeys or knick-knacks which have an emotional value. And so when I came to Australia and went to visit my mother, what do you give a mother, you know, when you've just been to Australia? A kangaroo, that's right. You know, a fluffy kangaroo. I actually love that kangaroo. You know, it's just a nice, cuddly toy. But, you know, it's a sign her son was living in Australia. So she put it on her mantelpiece. And the next time I went over there, I managed to get her a wombat. And she still had the kangaroo on there, so she put the wombat next to it. The next time I went to see her, I managed to get a kookaburra. And she had that on there. And the trouble was, there was not enough, but no, a koala as well, another trip. By the time I got the kookaburra, there was a wombat, a kangaroo, and a, what was the other one? A koala bear. Koala, yeah. And I tried to get the kookaburra on there, and all sorts of other stuff, and my brother as well. And she put it on the mantel shelf, and all this rubbish fell off. She couldn't balance on it. I said, look, Mum, why don't you throw those things away? They're old. She said, oh, no. They have this emotional value to me. They're important to me. And she had so much rubbish on there that she couldn't put anything new on it. The poor kookaburra kept on falling off and taking other stuff with it. Now that's the opposite of a non-stick mind. That's the accumulating mind. You get so much stuff on it that eventually things just fall off and make a mess. Now that's your mind. Sometimes there's so much stuff in it. You try and put something else in it and just, you go crazy because it's just too much. It overflows. You don't need to keep all that stuff. Just empty it out. This beautiful shelf in your mind is totally free. So someone you love can come and give you a kookaburra and you've got a space to put it. And as soon as somebody else comes and gives you a koala, kookaburra goes and the koala goes in its place. That's a non-stick mind. Now that's what we mean. That's how it works. But don't be like my mother's mantle shelf. There's so much stuff on it. You know, it's just a mess. Anyway, next question. Is there any point to do a daily 10 minutes to 20 minutes meditation? Of course there is. Because, as Ajahn Chah said, if you can't meditate for half an hour, at least meditate for 20 minutes. If you can't do 20 minutes, at least 10 minutes. If not 10 minutes, 5. If not 5, at least 2. If not 2, 1. At least you're meditating for 1 minute. So you start from there, first of all. And then after a while, you just build it up. So this, you know, you've got to sort of start from somewhere. So even 1 minute is worth it, just reminding yourself of meditation. Just reminding, even if you can't get peaceful, at least you're reminding yourself of meditation is important. And 1 minute spent meditating is much, much, much better than no minutes meditating. So at least 1 minute. What are the stupas and what do they have to do with meditation? Ah, the stupas is a word, that's the Sanskrit word, the Pali word is tupa, it means a mound. And when the holy people or kings were buried in those days, well, they would be cremated, but the ashes would then be buried under a mound of earth. And on top of the mound they put a parasol. The umbrella was not just to keep off the wind and not keep off the sun and the rain and the bird shit, it was to keep it's a symbol of royalty, a symbol of status. And so even now, the popes, the Catholic popes, they have a seven-tiered umbrella. And it's according to the old Catholic tradition, only the popes could have the seven-tier umbrella. I think the best emperor, you could only have six-tier umbrellas. It's a status. And that all came from India. The tiers and umbrellas, and kings would have umbrellas and big tiers of umbrellas. So umbrella was actually a symbol of status. So in the time of the Buddha, when an important person was cremated, they put this mound on top and they put an umbrella at the top. Now that umbrella, even in some of the old stupas which are excavated in India, they have the dome, the stick coming up, and they'd actually make a stone circle for the umbrella. You've actually seen some of those in the museums. Obviously it's very unstable because it's big stone on this little shaft and it would often fall off. So what was usually left was the mound and the stick coming up, the spire. So you can see on the stupa out there, you've got the dome. Now it's been changed now to something with holes in it with a Buddha inside, because that's from Borobudur. But the stick going up the centre, the spire, with the shaft of an umbrella. And now you know where we get the spires from Christian cathedrals. Coming from that tradition, it was an umbrella shaft. So if you go to any of these great cathedrals in Europe, or even in your hometown in Sydney or Perth, if you see a steeple there, that started off as a umbrella shaft. But they haven't got the umbrella on top anymore. That's where it came from. It's interesting to find out simple things, and this is what happens to them over the space of many, many, many centuries. And so that most stupas now, they've got some sort of dome and a stick up the centre, which was used to be the umbrella. And that's actually what the stupas are. And because they held the relics of, you know, enlightened monks or Buddhas, they became objects of worship. So that people actually worship those relics. As I mentioned many times, they aren't the real relics of the Buddha. You may go actually into Bodhinyana Monastery over the road. You see our relic display. We keep them out in the open there so people can actually see them. Instead of some of these scallywag temples, they actually have these relics and they charge people to see them, have these relic exhibitions. I remember going to Singapore to a relic exhibition and they're charging people a lot of money to go in. It's just like a fundraiser, just to make money for things. And so, you know, really against that. If you want to see relics, you can see some really good relics, some really top class relics for free at Bodhinyana Monastery. We're sort of undercutting the market, which I like doing. And you can actually see them. In some places, like the tooth relic in Kandy, you can't even see it. And people actually file past, but it's, you know, in this little room, which you can just about see through the window. And even if you're seen a monk, because I'm quite well known in Sri Lanka, you can actually get inside. But still you can only see the casket. No one would ever show you the actual tooth. And there's a good reason for that, because in Singapore they had a tooth relic, and they did display it. Unfortunately, a dental expert had a look at that and said, that's not a human tooth, that's a cow's tooth. And they just finished building this $50 million. Is it $50 million or $100 million? $56 million. $56 million temple around a cow tooth. It's crazy, there's Buddhists. Now, that's not the relics of the Buddha. We put them on display there to sort of show people, no, these are just bones, but what are the real relics of the Buddha? Dhamma is the relic of the Buddha. That's what the Buddha bequeathed to people. And that's in the the Dhammadhyata Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. He said, don't be heirs to my material things, be heirs to my spiritual things. That's your inheritance. The relic of the Buddha is the Dhamma. So if you want to see Buddha relics, look inside your heart in deep meditation. You see the Dhamma. That is the relics of the Buddha. And people should be worshipping that, not these bits of bone. But you have a stupa, actually, to put around those. So actually the stupas we have here in Borobudur is much better, because instead of having bones you can't see, you can actually see a beautiful picture or statue of the Buddha inside those stupas. That's a good idea. Much more beautiful. Dear Ajahn, I thought today is Thursday. As a result, I missed my kitchen clean-up duties, but I joined the Friday team. I felt sad as soon as I came to know there's only 2 days left. What do you mean, sad, only 2 days left? 2 days is 48 hours. 48 hours is 2,880 minutes, which is, I must be about, 170,000 seconds. It's huge, 170,000 opportunities to become enlightened. What are you worried about? It's almost over. 170,000, that's a huge opportunity. So it's not 2 days left, 170,000 seconds left. Oh, great, bring it on. Question, could you please briefly explain the four jhanas again? Briefly? It took me all day to do these things. So, in brief. More still than you've ever been before. Nothing moves, so your body has completely disappeared. 5 senses gone, and you just left. What's left is fully aware, blissful, powerful. First jhana, but still wobbling. The bliss is stable, but not quite. It's perfectly still. As you get confidence, it's the last bit of the mind controlling, the tiny remnant disappears. So that beautiful bliss is just staying there, immovable. Second jhana is the perfection of samadhi, the perfection of stillness. I mean, perfect stillness. Now really that means nothing moves. Perfect, perfect, perfect stillness. And that's nothing at all going anywhere. And you can't even make it move. You can't move, neither can your object. You're frozen, like a statue. but still with lots of bliss. And then the bliss, because it doesn't move, starts to disappear. Even bliss starts to vanish. First of all, the pity part of the bliss vanishes, and you're in the third jhana. And then because it doesn't move, the sukha vanishes. Perfectly still, with equanimity, the fourth jhana. Remember, when things are still, something disappears at each stage. And it's the what vanishes describes what the jhanas are. Never think that you can understand the jhanas by what's there. It's by what's gone describes those jhanas. For that tadpole, it's the absence of water. That's how it understands dry land. It's the absence of the body in the five senses. That's what describes first jhana. That's why they call it vivicha kamehi, vivicha kusalehi damehi. Vivicha means separated from the five senses and the hindrances. It's what's missing describes the first jhana. And it's what's missing. The vitaka vichara describes the second jhana, the last movement of the mind which stops you being still. It's what's missing describes the third jhana, no more pity. It's what's missing describes the fourth jhana, the absence of sukha. That's what's missing is how you know what jhana is. Not what's there, but what's disappeared. And nimitta can be identified as a bright light. How can we identify a jhana? Oh, I just told you that one. By what's missing. Not by what's there, by what's disappeared. This question, can you include a metta meditation session at the last day of the retreat? Who knows? The last day of the retreat is a long way in the future. And actually, remember the story I told last night? People have been saying that they're having a very, very wonderful retreat. So I think I should announce now the retreat has been extended for... You're not going home. Amanda has just actually put this new lock on the gate at the top there, so I've got the key. You're not going... What time the retreat ends on Sunday? 3 p.m. just to arrange a pick-up, not so much dwelling in the future. Yeah, 3 p.m. Usually 3 p.m. we finish off. So we will probably do a metta meditation if you're still alive by then. You mentioned that the Western paradise cannot be true. Why then do so many great Mahayana teachers preach it? Doesn't those learned teachers able to differentiate the truth? One of the things in ancient culture, we always follow our leaders. Even in school, teacher tells you something and you just believe it. It's the Westerners, always rebellious. We create a lot of trouble for our teachers by always questioning everything. That's why it's really a pain being a teacher in the West. Because the monks question everything, but actually that's great. If they didn't question everything, I'd be very disappointed in them. And they do argue, and I encourage that argument. Because that's the way we challenge. That's called ahipatika. You know, come and see, and pachatang vedittabo venyuhi. To be experienced every wise person for themselves. So you don't just believe. You question and investigate. Unfortunately, in many traditions, you're not allowed to investigate or question. Your teacher said it, therefore it must be true. And even Ajahn Chah, one of the last teachings he gave, because I was there just before, about a month before he had a stroke and couldn't actually speak again. That was when I came to Australia. So I was there just almost towards the end of his teaching life. And he would put his hand out, and he would make his hand like a crab, like a poo. And he said, once there was a mother crab who had a bad leg, and so she would walk funny. She wouldn't walk like a normal crab. And so then she found all her children were also walking like mummy with a limp. And mummy said, look, I've got a bad leg. That's why I limp. You shouldn't follow me. But no matter how many times Mother Crab said you shouldn't walk with a limp, all the children walk with a limp again as well. And that's what Ajahn Chah said, you disciples, you know, you just imitate me. You know, I walk with a limp, so you walk with a limp as well. You shouldn't imitate your teacher, was his advice. But that's what people tend to do. And especially in Asia, the teacher, especially the monk, the nun, is revered too much. So the teacher says something, it must be right. And this is not Buddhism, this is Asian culture. In Buddhism, I said already, in Mahaparinibbana Sutta, it doesn't matter how senior and respected that monk is, or nun, or teacher, compare it to the suttas. Compare it to truth and experience. And if it is in line with truth, experience, say, well said, that's a great teaching. If it's not, it's the wrong teaching. So you should always question. And that's actually, that big degree of questioning is actually opening up Buddhism, especially in Asia. It has to happen. Because it's reason, it's logic. Otherwise we're just like, you know, some of the Christians who believe this world was begun 5,000 years ago. And there's a God and Jesus looking after you. And it's absolute nonsense. But it's amazing why people believe in that. Why? Because the teacher told us. So you can't go on like that any longer. Because some teachers are unreliable. So, there's Buddhism. We don't teach you what to believe. We teach you how to find out for yourselves. That's one of the great things about Buddhism. That was early Buddhism. That is true Buddhism. We don't teach you what to believe, but teach you how to find out. So Pure Land, find out. Have a look at that teaching. Read the book by Professor A.K. Warder, Indian Buddhism. And you can actually see the umpire. Someone who's not even a Buddhist, but a great scholar, can actually give you reasonable arguments why that particular sutta described in the Pure Land was very, very late. That's about 1,000 years after the time of the Buddha, when it was written. And that makes it very interesting. You mentioned the four immaterial jhanas lie within the material jhana. When Prince Siddhartha first renounced, this question. He studied under two great meditation teachers and he has already attained the highest immaterial jhana. This means that he would have known the four material jhanas. Why then does he need to remember his boyhood experience before embarking on the correct path to enlightenment? Good question. And the answer is that those teachers, they couldn't have been teaching the true immaterial attainments. Under Alara Kalama, he was supposed to attain to the state of nothingness. Later on he said, that state of nothingness, he said later on, elsewhere in the suttas, he said that state of nothingness is a basis for the attaining of enlightenment. But that particular state, he said, had nothing to do with enlightenment. He couldn't make use of it at all. The only logical solution to that dilemma is that those Alara Kalama did not teach the real thing. Udaka Ramaputta, he was actually the disciple of Udaka Rama. That's what Udaka Ramaputta means. He wasn't the teacher. The teacher had passed away, but a disciple. And as a disciple, he was just saying what his teacher taught, the state of neither perception nor non-perception. The Buddha attained that, but it couldn't have been the same thing as the immaterial jhana. Because that, as you say, you have to go through the jhanas to get that. That is powerful stuff. And he said afterwards, in that particular type of body, where he was ascetic, he said you can't attain jhanas with that type of asceticism. So he was saying never attain the jhanas. So what is happening here, and what most people agree now in my explanation of this, is that those two teachers weren't teaching the real thing. In the same way that even today there are some people teaching things, they call them jhanas, they're certainly not jhanas. In the same way that you can write off the United States and send, I don't know how much it is these days, $100, by return of post you can get a PhD. It's not the real thing, it's got the same name, PhD. But it's not recognized anywhere because you just sent $100 and just got it by return of post. It doesn't show you've done any study. So sometimes your qualifications sort of are lowered to meet the demand. And to see even today, jhanas, people have heard that word, they want to attain it. And my jhanas, the way I describe them, is very high. 5 senses completely gone. You can't hear, you can't think. Other people say, oh no, you can still think, just get a little bit of happiness, and that's jhana. And of course, which would be more popular? Now, I don't go with Ajahn Brahm, it's just too tough. You can go with this other teacher over there and everyone gets jhanas. It's not the real thing. So that would be what's happening now, and that's probably what happened in the time of the Buddha. It wasn't the real thing. That's why the Buddha had to go and do the real thing, go back into the real jhanas. Yeah?
You said before that the intelligence that the Buddha practiced before became enlightened, that the body, mind, and system probably couldn't sustain the jhanas. Am I to assume then that you need a halfway decent healthy body to be able to tolerate energy in jhanas?
I'll just repeat your question in brief. You say that you need a halfway decent body to be able to get the jhanas. This is what the Buddha said. After realizing he was getting nowhere with the ascetic practices, including the practice under Alaraka Lama and Uddaka Ravaputta, that's when he remembered being under the rose apple tree as a kid and getting into a first jhana. And then he thought, why am I afraid of that pleasure which has nothing to do with sensuality? Like some people today are afraid of that pleasure. They say you get attached to it. And the Buddha said, I will not be afraid of that pleasure. He said, perhaps that's the way to Bodhi, to enlightenment. The insight arose. Yes, that is the way to Bodhi, to enlightenment. That's Mahasachika Sutta number 36 of the Digha Nikaya. Check it out. That's what it says, verbatim. And then he thought, it's not easy to gain those jhanas with such an emaciated, weary body. What now if I would eat and rest? And that's what he did. And as soon as he started eating properly and resting, his five friends, the five ascetics, looked at him and said, he's given up the practice. And they left him. He changed so much that his five friends lost faith in him. So he was alone. Now he had a healthy body. And then he got jhanas. And when he went to teach those five friends, they took one look at him and thought, what's he talking about, being enlightened? You know, a guy like that, he never got enlightened when he was being ascetic. And now he thinks he gets enlightened now? And they realized he was. And that's why the first thing he taught his five ascetics, the first five students, middle way. Avoiding extremes, because without that, middle way, you can't get the jhanas, you can't fulfill the Eightfold Path. So the middle way was actually telling a person, don't indulge the senses, but don't be austere. Be kind to your body. Don't just throw away your mats and sit on the hard floor, or even like some people like to do, sprinkle broken glass or put nails in there to sit on, thinking the more pain, the more gain. Use your mats. Sit on the chairs. The chairs are the middle way for those people with sore legs or sore back. Then you can get the jhanas. But if you've got achy legs, achy body, and you're in pain, you're never going to get those jhanas. This is not anapana sati, anapana sati. He explained to the disciples next to the main Buddha statue are, but who are those two goblin-looking creatures on... two goblin-looking creatures on each side of him. Also, what is the significance of the dragon? Oh, up there. Those are usually yakas. And yakas are these... Well, sometimes they're good yakas, sometimes they're bad yakas. And some of the good yakas are the ones who protect the Buddha. So if you're a good Buddhist, you're a good person, you've got nothing to worry about. But if you're a bad person, those yakas will jump up and eat you. So it says. So they're yakas. Sometimes they're protectors. We often hear and see in books about mind and matter, nama rupa. What happens, can you explain the mind when one is liberated non-self at the death when one is reborn? This is another point where the Abhidharma just really stuffed up and complicated things. In the suttas it's very clear, nama rupa means the mental objects and physical objects. It excludes consciousness. Nama-rupa does not mean mind and matter. That's Abhidharma, complicated things, and confused everybody. In the suttas, nama-rupa were the objects of mind. Vijnana, consciousness, was the mind. Mind and its objects. which is why in the dependent origination they say that nama rupa and mind or consciousness, they support one another. In other words, to have consciousness, you have to be conscious of something. To be conscious of something, you need a mind. They support one another. And even in the Samudaya Sutta, Sanyutta Nikaya, he said, the citta, the mind, it arises and passes away. It's not permanent. There is no such thing as an original mind. It says in there that citta arises because of nama rupa. When it's objects of mind, then you have the mind. When it's something to see, then you have sight. Sight is not there independent of the objects of sight. You only have consciousness when you have something to see. You only have hearing when there's sound. You only have mind when there's something to know. Otherwise, there is no mind. It stops. That is the teaching of the Buddha, Samudaya Sutta, when it goes into the Satipatthana. You know, in the Satipatthana you're supposed to see rise and fall. What does that mean? It explains it in the Sanyutta Sutta of the Samudaya. It's in the Nidana Sanyutta. It says what it means is you see the cause of these things. It's not to see mind changing. Say, where does mind come from? You see the origin, not the rise, but the origin of mind. It comes from nama rupa. You see where mind ceases, where nama rupa ceases. Just like a flame comes from the fuel, the oil, say. When the oil is there and heat and whatever, then you have a flame. When the oil is taken away, the flame is gone. When there's no nama rupa, no citta. That's how the Buddha taught it. So that's what nama rupa really means. Unfortunately, that sutta explanation has been completely confused by the Abhidhamma, which had a completely different definition of nama rupa. And that's why Abhidhamma is confusing, and that's one of the many confusing points which come from the Abhidhamma. So when one is liberated, non-self, is when you're an arahat, you still have mind, you still have nama rupa, but the cause of rebirth has been destroyed. The seed of rebirth has gone. So you're just using your old karma up. In other words, you're still alive, sentient. But at the time of an arahat's death, then everything stops. Which is why they used to say that an arahat, these are the arahats in the time of the Buddha, this is how they described it. They say they're like workmen having completed their job, waiting for their wages. They've done all the work, they haven't got the paycheck yet. They're arahat, fully enlightened, it's only the time of their death, the parinibbana, they get the paycheck, full freedom, end of suffering, no rebirth. However, if you're not enlightened yet, your consciousness, nama rupa, supporting each other, they will keep the whole process going. Rolling, 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 nama rupa. You see, you heard that, but you weren't hearing until that sound happened. And the sound happened, the sound consciousness came together, and then there was hearing. There's no consciousness without the objects of consciousness. Buddha called it like two sheaves leaning against each other. Take one sheave off, the other one falls down. That's what nama rupa is. Your mind, your consciousness is not always there. It's not permanent, it's not you, it's not a self. When the objects go, so does the consciousness stop. And that's how the jhanas work, and especially immaterial. Immaterial jhanas, the objects of consciousness, the nama rupa is disappearing. The nama rupa disappears first, and then the consciousness stops afterwards. Which is why you have neither perception nor non-perception. What does that mean? The non-perception means nama rupa has stopped. We have nothing to see. But you see there's nothing to see. The mind hasn't quite stopped yet. It's on its way to stopping. One sheaf has been taken away and the other one is falling over. When there's nothing to see, when there's no objects of consciousness, then the citta stops. And that's asanya vedana nirodha. Can you please explain about the difference between karma and cause and effect? Sukihotu. Yes, karma is cause and effect. It just shows you just how your willed actions and willed speech and willed thoughts, that's what karma is, your controlled actions, speech and thoughts create things in this world. The will is the creator, not God, but you. So don't blame anybody else for what's gone wrong in this retreat. You created it. Your will creates your world. Sure, you can't suddenly will the drains to unblock. You have to get the plumber to do that. You can't will sort of the food to be exactly what you like tomorrow morning. But what you can will is the way you relate to all these things. You can will to make peace, be kind, be gentle. Or you can will to make trouble, to make war, to hate. That is up to you. So, that's what we mean by the making of karma. It's not what you experience, but how you experience it is what karma is all about. And I mentioned in the first talk here, meditation karma. Good meditation karma is making peace, letting go, being kind, being gentle. If you understand that, you can meditate every moment, not by just trying to be mindful every moment, but by being peaceful every moment, by being kind every moment, by being gentle every moment. And that is good meditation karma. And what happens when you make the causes correct? You get the beautiful effects. That's how you get still. That's how you get into jhana. That's how you get insight. That's how you get enlightened. It's not what you do, but how you do it creates enlightenment. But instead, sometimes we do the wrong causes. We don't really understand. So we've got a problem. I'm going to force my way through it. I'm going to sit all night tonight. I'm going to destroy my defilements. I'm going to get in line. Only 2 days to go. Only 180,000 seconds to go. I'm not going to waste 1 second. Okay, mind, you're in trouble. I'm going to beat you down. Now, with that type of aggression, people do that. And what do they get? They just get stuffed up in their head big time. And this is, they think, oh, I can't meditate. And the reason they can't meditate is because they don't know how to meditate. They've got the wrong ideas. If you make good meditation karma, you get peace, you get a sense of freedom, you get bliss and joy. Make bad meditation karma, you just get more suffering. So this is cause and effect, that's all it is. And my job is just to tell you what the right causes are. And your job is to put those causes into place. Easy. Next question. Can an arahat assist a deceased person to upgrade from his current realm to a better realm through meditation? The Buddha once gave this amazing teaching. He said, suppose a person got a pot of ghee, like ghee is oil. Say they got a pot of oil, like in a clay pot, and they took it to like a lake, and they broke that pot over the lake. And then the pot would fall into the lake, the oil would float on the surface, and the shards of pot would go down to the bottom. Then suppose that he was a powerful monk, and he chanted and chanted the Ratana Sutta, the Metta Sutta, whatever sutta. Oh, may those clay shards rise to the surface, and may the oil go to the bottom. And the Buddha said, what would you expect to happen? And the monk said, you'd just get weariness and tired and frustrated. He said, exactly, monks. You know, you go according to your karma. So all the chanting in the world will not make Adolf Hitler go to heaven, even if you are a relation of his. And all the chanting in the world won't make your really, you know, brilliant friend who you hate for some reason or another fall from hell and go to fall from heaven and go to hell because you don't like him. The only time that chanting can work when people are just on the edge. That's a little nudge here or a nudge there. But mostly it's up to your karma. And I say that, and many monks get upset. You know why? Because I'm taking away a great source of their income. To be able to chant at house blessings or at funerals. So why do you do that? Look at what the Buddha said. We go according to our karma. What monks can do is actually teach Dhamma so people can find out for themselves. So they don't go, you know, down to hell, they can go up to heaven, because we can inspire you. And that can be done for somebody who has just died, because they can still be around. If a monk teaches them Dhamma, and then they can hear what's being said, and they can be able to let go and just get to a better rebirth. But the chanting, look, how many of you understand Pali chanting? You don't understand it now, you're not going to understand it when you're dead. So whatever we chant, you won't understand a word we're saying. Same as Tibetan chanting as well, the same. It sounds really cool, but I haven't got a clue what they're saying. Except sometimes I've been with these other Tibetan monks, some mates of mine, and these people have been chanting, and the Tibetan said, he's chanting all wrong, that's not what he's supposed to chant. But no one knows, because it sounds good. Well, I've done that before. Sometimes I get very tired, sort of at a wedding. I've done the funeral chants by mistake. Or really, was it by mistake? Or was it one of those Freudian slips? Because you know what I think about weddings. This is a death, really, a death of your freedom. But no one notices, because they don't know when I'm chanting. I shouldn't have that on tape, I'm getting in trouble now. Anyway, next question. Okay. Is it true to offer to an arahant will have a greater merit than just an ordinary monk? Yes. If you offer to an arahant, it's more merit than offering to an ordinary monk. But offering to a sangha is even more merit than offering to a Buddha. Now that is really good. So you don't offer to a monk, you offer to a sangha. So if you give a donation, don't give a donation to this monk, to that monk, to that monk, and to that nun. Give a donation to the monastery, to the sangha. The Buddha said you get far greater merit than offering to an individual. If you give it to an individual, I'm doing the teaching here, so I get all the money. And these poor guys at the end, they just get the leftovers. That's not how we work it in a sangha. We share everything. The robes I wear are actually probably worse than the monks' robes they wear. My bag has got patches in it. So you may give me all these nice robes, but I share it with all the other monks and nuns. That's how we do things, because it's offered to a sangha, not to an individual. And that's even higher merit, according to the Buddha. So if you're making an offering, never make an offering to this monk or that monk, even if you think he's enlightened. Or not even to a nun. Offer it to a sangha. And then it's shared, and that's higher merit. And it also protects the monks so that they don't have individual property. We're not into material things. We're supposed to have left the world. So what would you think if I had a Gucci robe? I said, Bob, what are you doing? Now I got into real big trouble, so... Oh no, I won't say that. Right here. The Buddhist-Greek connection is fascinating. Further to that, it was the Muslim scientists Al-Kindis and Al-Hasan who carried and passed on the mantle of Greek thought to the Christians. That's true, because they're not just... Yeah, it was Greek thought, Socrates and... I think one of those, no, it was Erasmus, when he first, 12th century, when he first read, I think it was Plato, he thought, that guy must be a saint. And Francis Bacon, the 12th century Franciscan friar, outlined a scientific method based on the Muslim transfer of Greek thinking, in particular Aristotle, but the idea of experiment, including the element of experience. Good. This experiential level of science was counter to Christian doctrine, and so Bacon left it out. In fact, the whole scientific method was reshaped to fit Christian doctrine. The modern-day scientific method is devoid of the richness included in experiential knowledge. The Christians have a lot to answer for. And it's true because, you know, evidence sometimes countered belief. Especially a belief which was a revealed truth. And sometimes people ask, what's the difference between Buddhism and Christianity, Islam, Judaism? And one of the major differences is Buddhism is not a revealed religion. It's a realized religion. And revealed religion is, here's the truth, it's come down from God or from Buddha or from Ajahn Chah or whatever, therefore it must be true, believe it or get out of here, you're excommunicated. That's called a revealed truth. A realized truth is, you realize it for yourself. Here's the instructions, here's the guidebook, off you go. I'm here to help you, any questions, come back and I'll help you on the path. But you have to walk that path, you realize it for yourself. Buddhism has always been a realized religion. And part of a realized religion, you can always argue, you can always question, you can always reject things which don't fit. Which is great. However, a realized religion means that the priests, the monks, have hardly any power at all. Once you realize you don't need me anymore, that's wonderful. I can be free and have a bit of rest for a change. But when it's a revealed religion, and only the priests or the monks can explain it to you, then they have power. So revealed religions have a lot of hierarchy and power figures. Realized religions don't have that. However, sometimes Buddhism does become a revealed religion, especially something like the Abhidhamma. The only people who understand it is monks. So they have a lot of power, they have to explain it to you. Or if chanting really works and gets your mother up to heaven when she should really be in hell, then of course the monks have power. So we try and get rid of that power trip. Okay, Ajahn, what happens to citta once you leave this present vehicle? Find a new vehicle straight away, hang around for some time or what? When is the next birth? As soon as you die and this body falls apart, first of all you have what's called a manomayakai. The citta makes a body as you would expect to have. So it's again, the perception makes a body for you. So, if you die wearing white, your manomayakaya is wearing white. That's what you expect. It's a continuity. You don't think that you've changed clothes yet, so you wear the clothes you died in. Or if your wife changes your clothes when you're in your coffin, then those are the clothes which you start wearing again. So many times when people see ghosts, they're wearing the clothes they died in, or they're wearing the clothes in their coffin, whatever they were changed into. And this is just what the mind expects to be wearing. So that it's actually a mind-made body. Your mind makes a body until it actually finds a more solid body to go into if you get reborn. So this is what a citta does. If it hasn't got a physical body, it makes itself one. It hangs around for some time. Yes, it does. And that's where the ghosts come from. The beautiful ghosts who come around and say, "Do you want to hear a number?" "Yes, please." "You said before that you might be sad at someone's funeral who wasted their life. What do you mean by this?" "Because I'm not sad that a person dies. I'm sad the way they live their life." People, for example, wealthy people. Wealthy people had all this money to make good use of, to do something worthwhile in society. To look after temples, retreat centres, look after sort of old people's homes or other charities such as hospitals. And what do? They haven't used it at all. They spent it on themselves or just kept it in the bank. And the end of their life, what have they used it for? Just what a waste of all that resource. People have been fit and healthy and they haven't used it to develop their minds. So in meditation, they haven't taken the opportunity to understand Dharma. Had all that opportunity and they just wasted it. That's a waste of that. That's what makes me sad. People have had the chance and they haven't used it. And you understand why? Said, well, what do you do that for? You had all these things going for you, the opportunities. You had in Perth a great Buddhist centre, a nice retreat centre. So make use of it. Come. Don't just come once, come again. So you make use of this before the time comes you're so sick or so old you can't make use of it. We try and make it sort of so you can use it when you're old and sick, but there comes a time when you can't make use of this. So don't waste your time. And when I see people wasting the opportunities and time, that's what makes me sad. Oh, what do you do that for? Dhruvajampavam have been doing the morning and evening chanting for years now and still don't fully understand what it means. I know the translation on the opposite page of the chanting book, but I would like to know the meaning of each word and the basic grammar so that I can chant it with real feeling. Can you recommend an easy guide to basic Pali to assist me? Yeah, there is an easy guide, and that's actually also by that A.K. Warder, Introduction to Pali. You keep it simple. It's just like, if you learn Latin, it's not that hard to learn. And actually, once you start learning a bit of Pali, wow, the whole suttas, it opens up to you. Because you're seeing things in there. Sometimes it's hard to get an English meaning, an English word, which corresponds to the one you're looking at. An example of this is Satipatthana Sutta. At the very beginning, it keeps on saying, you do the, lost in the Satipatthana Sutta, you do body contemplation on the body, kaye kayanupassi. And at first, I followed everybody else. They translate, you do body contemplation in the body or on the body. And in the body means it must be something sort of profound, because I don't understand. Where else can you do body contemplation but on the body? And it was only later on, when you read Pali, you feel this is an idiom of Pali. You do floor sweeping on floors. You do car riding in cars. It's just the idiom. They keep repeating something where we would just have one verb. They would have the verb and the object. You do teeth brushing of teeth. That's just the way the Pali is. So when you understand this, you see it again and again and again for yourself, you realize that what that means, you just do body contemplation or mindful of the body. It's not body mindfulness on the body, it's just body mindfulness. The translation is adding something which is not there in the original. And then you've got Vinaya Loke Abhita Dhammanasang. That beautiful term there, because when I was reading the Pali, I remembered these things, I've got a good memory. Loke Abhija. I saw that many times, that term, as a synonym for the first hindrance, Kamachanda. It's so often, the five hindrances are mentioned hundreds of times. And I think I just roughly calculated about 40% of the time the first hindrance is called Loke Abhija. 60% of the time it's called Kamachanda. It's a synonym. It's two words with the same meaning. Then when I saw that, Vinaya Loke Abhija and Dhammanasang, it meant getting rid of the first hindrance. And Dhammanasang was a synonym for the second hindrance. It means getting rid of the two hindrances. Then you understood what Satipatthana meant. You do all these contemplations having already abandoned the first two hindrances. That's what it said. And all this talk about having, abandoned grief and covetousness for the world, which is the standard English translation, that's not what it meant. It meant having abandoned the two hindrances. And that actually was in the commentaries as well, but no one ever explained that. And when you saw it for yourself, now you understood what the Satipatthana was. Now you understand if you're doing Satipatthana for 7 days, you're not enlightened. Because you haven't abandoned the hindrances yet. You abandon the hindrances for 7 days and do Satipatthana, yeah, then you get enlightened. Hindrances have to be abandoned first. And this came when you read Pali, understood Pali, and you saw it there, very clear for yourself. So, understanding a little bit of Pali, you've all got good enough brains. It's amazing, you can read it for yourself, it's not that hard. And it's fascinating, the stuff which comes out. I try to convey it to you, but read it for yourself.